other side of the tape about what led to the gradual downfall of Montefiore Hospital as a Jewish hospital. And I add that because it still exists and it still functions, and I'm not familiar with its level or quality because I have very little or no contact with it now that it is totally a member of the university group. At any rate, the precedents going to Presbyterian Hospital, certain glaring facts emerged, facts which those of us in the of the so-called concerned physicians always predicted and always knew would happen. The first was that when it came to any decision about one of the hospitals starting something new that may develop in the future as a source of patients and therefore income, the Presbyterian Hospital always had the priorities, and nowhere was that more obvious than in the field of cardiology. It just so happens that the field of cardiology and cardiac surgery developed exponentially at Allegheny General Hospital, even more so than Presbyterian Hospital, because Allegheny General Hospital had a board of directors that was willing to move in the direction of advice that it received from its attending staff. Whereas at the medical center of the university, there was an effort to develop cardiac surgery, but not with the same level of intensity and competence, I believe, that we had at Allegheny General. So that was one serious fault. Montefiore was left out in the cold. They weren't even able to diagnose patients properly and correctly, as I explained with the basis of cardiac catheterization. But also, remember that Montefiore did not have any access to pediatric patients because Children's Hospital was two blocks away. Mm-hmm. Nobody of any significance ended up at Montefiore Hospital in pediatrics. It naturally went to the pediatric hospital, Children's Hospital. Nobody with OB-GYN problems ended up at Montefiore Hospital because Montefiore Hospital elected to save money, to combine its efforts with the efforts of McGee Women's, and all obstetric gynecological development was in that area and not at Montefiore Hospital. Montefiore Hospital also did not develop in the field of neurosurgery, which was my field, beyond where it was because of a lack of money to do it, and Montefiore Hospital, even though Montefiore Hospital brought in a full-time chief of neurosurgery, and his ability to attract patients was obviously not successful. So that there was no area, new or old, which Montefiore Hospital could develop except if it could have managed to stay within general medical and general surgical care of its patients. It had certainly one of the outstanding general surgical staffs prior to these changes. And as this group of surgeons gradually retired, moved on, or got on the staffs of other hospitals, there was nothing moving to take its place at Montefiore Hospital. And so I remember, not long after I left for Allegheny General Hospital, the president of the board at that time came here for dinner, and I will not mention his name, but he told me that Montefiore Hospital was losing $25,000 a day at that time, and that was, I would estimate, somewhere in the early 70s, so that it is not possible for a hospital to function at that level of daily loss unless they have some unlimited donors. As a result, they were forced to curtail some operations, one of which was nursing care. Therefore, they gradually wound down rather than up towards attracting patients. If you get bad nursing care or limited nursing care, it certainly is not conducive to attracting people to your hospital or to fill your beds. So that this becomes a cyclic phenomenon, gradually winding down towards a no-win situation. The critical error was, of course, as I mentioned earlier, the point at which the lifeblood of Montefiore Hospital, which was its excellent medical staff, and once they started to lose that, they lost their future. I always said, and though it sounds very conceited, but symbolically it's true, I was trained to be the neurosurgeon of Montefiore Hospital at the request of the then administrative staff, to the knowledge of the board of directors, and to the knowledge of the medical staff. I was sent away, urged to go away, become a specialist, and come back to Montefiore Hospital for that purpose. When they then allowed me to leave, they were, in a sense, giving away their future. This happened to me, it happened to Manny Cohn, it happened to many other cardiologists like Larry Adler, and so forth and so on. I could name literally dozens of well-trained young Jewish physicians who made their life and practice in this city and who were lost to Montefiore Hospital because they stood on the principle that they were right and we were wrong. And of course, they were able to win the day for only so long, and eventually they lost the day because it was not long ago that Montefiore Hospital was sold by the Jewish community to the University of Pittsburgh, and it is now a University of Pittsburgh hospital. One event that I must mention that is somewhat an anachronism and somewhat interesting to prove how duplicitous this whole situation was from the administration's point of view, was that at no time in the history of the relationship of Montefiore Hospital as a Jewish hospital to the University of Pittsburgh was there ever a chairman of a department who was at Montefiore Hospital. All department chairmen were at Presbyterian Hospital, and not that somebody from Montefiore Hospital would be promoted to chairman of the medical school department and then moved to Presbyterian Hospital. Nobody ever picked to be head of a department at Montefiore ever became overall chairman of that department at the medical school. It's an interesting fact. It was a fact that was not ignored or was not missed by the great Phil Trone, because he certainly would have been eligible as head of the department at Montefiore, Department of Medicine, to become the overall chairman of medicine at the university. He was passed over, and another person was given that job once that job was open. And when that happened, he reacted exactly as the attending physicians of Montefiore had reacted to him. He reacted by withdrawing from the university and starting his own residency program, precisely what we had said all along should have been done, but then it was too late. And still, he ran it as he wanted to run it under his circumstances.
Where did he do this?
At Montefiore Hospital.
At Montefiore. Yeah.
And I must say, it was. And why did he attract residents? Why was he able to fill residents? He was able to talk the board into putting up the money to do so. And residents, by and large, knew that at a Jewish hospital run by Jewish doctors, they're going to get a good education. So there was no problem, and it's something that we said all along would have happened had we not made that tight relationship with the university. Nonetheless, they had it their way, and now Montefiore Hospital belongs to the university. So Montefiore went literally through three revolutions. The first was when Lester Hamburg stood up, then president of the board, said, if you don't like it, leave. And the group went out and built Central Medical Division. The second revolution is when the medical staff sued Montefiore Hospital. Unfortunately, they lost. And the third and final was when the hospital was surreptitiously sold to the university without so much as a buy your leave or an explanation to the medical staff who had been so loyal through so many years.
What, did we get the year that it was?
I don't know the exact year, but it's about 5 years ago. This is 1995. I would say 89, 90, somewhere in that area. And you can perhaps, if you, maybe I can check that out later. But at any rate, it was sold by the president of the board of directors. And at no time was there even a, as my understanding, and I'm an outsider, and I was at Allegheny and heard this all by second dimension, but I think it was not even brought to a vote by the board of directors until after the deal was signed and sealed. And it was a deal that was made by the president of the board, the executive director of the hospital, and the university. The money, however, was put in a trust fund called the Healthcare Foundation, and a board was appointed to administer that money. Now, how do I feel about it? Well, I wasn't personally hurt by this last episode. I was well established at the Allegheny General Hospital, where I've made my career most of my life, and have put in over 30 years of service there. But many of my friends who were still practicing at Montefiore Hospital were seriously disrupted. They suddenly found themselves under the jurisdiction of the university chairmen of departments, and they had never been kindly to this group of physicians, never had considered them part of their departments, even though they were a university hospital at the time. And the circumstances became somewhat difficult for many of them. Now, what do I mean by this? People say, well, how could it affect them? What would matter as long as they were able to bring their patients in and operate on them? Well, as I told you earlier, the rules change, and people who have been practicing a certain way for a number of years aren't always willing or able to bend to those new rules. But one of the simplest rules of all is operating time. If you've been operating Monday morning and Wednesday morning and Friday morning at 8 o'clock for 20 years, and suddenly a new chairman of the department comes and says, you can only have operating time at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, this certainly disrupts your life, disrupts your practice, and disrupts your concept of yourself as being a master of your own fate. And these are the kinds of things that happen under new chairman, new heads of departments. So that, was it good? It was good in the sense, is there anything good? It was good in the sense that the Jewish community got rid of a losing situation, a situation which no longer could redeem itself. They were losing money on a daily basis, and this is not out of not out of the Federation's pocket necessarily, but out of it was Jewish money that was being drained.
Well, the Federation did give money to the Montefiore
Hospital. Yeah, no, $250,000 a year.
Less, $238,000.
$238,000. Well, I remember $250,000,
yeah. The Federation had a certain responsibility to Montefiore Hospital, and that was to pay the interest on the mortgage, and the mortgage payment, and that was dated from the time that, from 1939, when they first became an affiliate of the Federation, and that figure was accepted and continued, even though there were mortgages upon mortgages and many changes in the financing, but that became the figure for which the Federation assumed responsibility. Now, it was not, but nonetheless, the board of directors was all Jews. When they had a fundraising drive, it was from Jews, essentially, and therefore, a losing proposition was removed. It was like, in a way, cutting out a cancer. This not only stopped losses of money in the Jewish community, but it did this. We were no longer, I say we, the hospital no longer was serving its original purpose. The original purpose was that Jewish doctors could not get an education, could not get an appointment, could not practice anywhere except if there was a Jewish hospital. That no longer existed. Jewish patients could not, in times past, find a place where they could be treated according to their needs with regard to special religious obligations. That no longer exists. Every hospital clamors to get Jewish patients, and I can talk a little about that. But the most important thing was that here was now a big fund of money that could be used for other charitable purposes within the Jewish community. Most concerned to protect the board of directors and the president of the board at that time was that in, I believe it's 96, a year after from now, that a bond issue was coming due, and they probably would have had a default on those bonds. And that was a big decision that somebody had to make before 1996. So not only are those bonds going to be paid off, but there's this big fund. I think the fund now is $75 million, the interest of which is spent every year and has been a big crutch to the United Jewish Fund Drive. Substantial amount of money comes from that healthcare foundation to the UJF drive. I did say that I would make some comment about, what was it that I mentioned just a minute ago that I was going to make a comment about? But the one thing that I didn't mention, and that's the responsibility that the Jewish community had to support the indigent population of Pittsburgh was out of proportion with Montefiore Hospital to what other hospitals were doing. Why? Because we weren't attracting people from Johnstown and Steubenville and Weirton to support and fill our beds. We were attracting the local indigent population. We really weren't taking care of Jewish population per se. We were taking care of indigent population. People knew that they could get decent, good medical care without much objection, much resistance, and so that a large proportion of our beds were filled by people who were not a boon or a benefit to Montefiore Hospital. So, in a way, that was a load off the back of the Jewish community by literally dumping this in the lap of the university and at a good price. Okay. I think that's about all that I have to say on that subject about Montefiore Hospital.
Babe, can you tell us when and how you met your wife and what children there were and what year and what happened, what's their status now?
Okay. And she's laughing. My wife is laughing.
You got to leave here. You got to get out.
Well, first of all, I was married the first time. This is my I've been married twice. I was married the first time when I was in practice, and I'll talk about my practice experiences later. Mm-hmm. I was a general practitioner, and I had an office in Squirrel Hill. I met a young Jewish girl who was 10 years younger than myself. Mm-hmm. We were married, remained married for about 2.5 years, and were divorced. We were divorced at the time that I was in the Air Force, and I was overseas. And like many marriages during that phase of the war and so forth, the marriage fell apart, and so I then was a bachelor for, that was in 1950, I guess it was.
1950
to about 1953, something. And then I was divorced, and then was a bachelor and moved to New York for my specialty training, and was in New York and for the next several years. I left for left Pittsburgh in 1955, and I had a patient while I was in Pittsburgh who came from New York. His name was, and I say was, she recently died, Ann Ronell. And Ann Ronell was a songwriter, and she was a woman of some reputation in the music field because she wrote some very important music, such as Willow Weep for Me, which was a very well-known song, And she'd also done some classical work. She had
Who's Afraid of the
Big Bad Wolf, which she sued, which, by the way, she sued Disney for stealing, and got, many years later, got some reparations from Disney for that. And nonetheless, she was quite a active woman in the New York musical community. She did translation of Mozart into English.
What was her name? I forgot.
Anne Ronell, R-O-N-N-E-L-L. Her married name was Cowan. She was married to a movie director by the name of Lester Cowan. So she had a chronic pain problem and came to Pittsburgh to consult David Koskoff, who was also a musician. David Koskoff was my first preceptor, and we'll talk about that on another tape. But nonetheless, she came at a time when I was planning to leave for New York for my advanced training after finishing with David Koskoff, and she, having my number, started to treat with me and came to me with her pain problem. And of course, since I was a bachelor, and since she was a woman and a Jewish woman, she didn't let me rest for a moment and always had somebody for me to meet. In fact, her husband, Lester, directed the One Touch of Venus and was a very close friend of Ava Gardner. And one of the first people that they wanted to fix me up with was Ava Gardner. Fortunately, Ava Gardner got drunk and never made it to the date. So the next choice was this young woman who was a singer. And I remember saying to Anne Ronell on the telephone, I don't want to meet any career women. I'm tired of career women. I want to meet a woman who wants to make a home for me and my future children and who will be happy to do that. And she said to me, oh, she says, I have just the gal for you. She's a singer, but I know very well that she's much more interested in meeting the right man. So I said, Anne, you've fooled me too many times, and I'm not going to go through with it. So she said, listen, I said to her, do me a favor. You have a cocktail party, and invite her to the cocktail party, and I'll come to the cocktail party, and I'll see her from across the room. She said, okay, I'll do it. So naturally, being a resident, I was at Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center at that time, at Columbia University. And I worked late. I didn't get there, and they were waiting for me. I walked in, and the cocktail party consisted of Anne Ronell, this young woman whose name was Radin, Sadell Radin, and Lester Cowan. Lester Cowan was ready to go to bed, and neither Anne Ronell nor Sadell Radin had had any dinner.
Radin,
R-A-D-I-N, which is short for Radinsky.
Mm-hmm.
Smorodinsky, I think. Mm-hmm. It's prompting me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ended up with two women that I had to take to dinner. And we went to dinner. I remember where it was. We went to dinner at a French restaurant, which was one of my hangouts at the time. And we had a very lovely evening. We were talking politics and philosophy. And I remember specifically ignoring her because I didn't think that she could enter into this discussion. And then she said something very brilliant. And I sort of took another look at her and I said, why, this person knows what they're talking about. I was rather shocked about that. But nonetheless, I thought that she was quite interesting and attractive. And this was a French restaurant with a strolling violinist. And the violinist came by our table, and he knew me well because I ate there frequently. And he knew that I had certain songs I liked, and he would start to play these songs. And while he's playing, this Sadell Radin starts to sing. And I nearly fell off of my chair. She was, and the whole restaurant just absolutely were beside themselves. Everybody was staring and looking. So at any rate, this was the beginning of a wonderful friendship. which culminated in marriage exactly 3 months later. And as a matter of fact, she proposed to me, I guess it was 3 weeks after that. Well, not exactly she proposed, but what happened was I said to her, maybe we ought to get married. And she said, okay, when?
You proposed, believe me.
So we decided to get married. Nonetheless, we got
married. What year was that?
Well, I'll tell you how close it was. Now, wait a minute. It was less than 3 months because my mother came to New York to see me with her husband, Elmer Hamburg, and...
No,
they weren't married yet. They were just dating. They came to New York for New Year's. And we went out New Year's Eve, and I remember I had another date on New Year's Eve, so I arranged to see Sibel the following day. And we met for lunch at the Plaza Hotel, where I introduced her to my mother and to Elmer. And then I said to them, I had three dates that weekend, and she was the last of the three. And I said to my mother, which one do you like best? And she said the last one.
Uh-huh.
So at any rate, about a week later, my first preceptor in neurosurgery, Yale Kostkoff, came to New York, and I called her on the telephone, and I said, my best friend is here, my preceptor, and I'd like, would you meet us for dinner? She says, I'm sorry, I have arrangements with a friend. So I said, what do you mean, what kind of arrangements? Well, a girlfriend. So I said, I couldn't help but admire the fact that she would not break those arrangements just to go out with me. She stuck to her guns. And the next week that I called her, I made a date for the following week, we hit it off quite well, and that's when we decided maybe we should get married. At any rate, we were married March the 2nd, so that it was, we really met somewhere toward the end of December.
March 2nd, what year?
Of the same year, that was 1957. Now, we had met over the Christmas holidays, somewhere in that area. We weren't even together on New Year's Eve, though I must say, on New Year's Eve, after my other date, I stopped at her house, her apartment, which was on 91st Street. She lived on, I remember, a third floor walk up on 91st Street. She was an independent young woman, and she had her own business at the time. She had many businesses. She had worked for Mademoiselle magazine as a fashion director. She had a little shop that was on 42nd Street called the Shoplift, where she sold antique jewelry. So she had her hands in many things. But the thing that struck me when I forgot to tell you, the most significant thing that struck me, and probably is a relates even to my character today and my thoughts. Anne Rennell said to me, and Anne Rennell had this tremendous ability to dramatize, and that was her role in life. Of course, she was a writer and a songwriter. She said to me on the phone, trying to talk me into meeting her the first time, I said, well, who is she? Where did she come from? What's her family like? Oh, she doesn't have any family. She's an orphan. Well, that's all she had to tell me, and I said, immediately I felt sorry for her, and I thought I'd better take care of her. Turned out that it was a slight exaggeration. Her parents had died when she was already divorced from her first marriage.
It wasn't divorced, it was annulled.
Annulled woman.
And I was only in my 20s
when
they died.
But when I met her, she was 29 years old, so she was certainly not a poor, lonely orphan. She had a rather well-developed family, about 90 cousins and sisters and brothers and nieces and nephews.
Sounds like we're going to have to interview Sibel next.
So at any rate, we were married on March the 2nd, and in attendance at that date, we were married in the study of a very well-known rabbi in New York.
Who?
I don't remember his name.
Okay.
His name was Rosenthal or Rosenberg or something. At any rate, we were very, my sister, my wife's sister, it's still there.
No, they're still there.
My wife's sister was late. And I remember in New York, it's hard to get to where you want to get to in time and park. And so she was quite late. The rabbi was very upset because he had to listen to Fibber McGee and Molly. He was afraid he was going to miss Fibber McGee. So at any rate, we were married, and in attendance, my sister-in-law, my brother-in-law, and their respective spouses, David Koskoff and Betty Koskoff, his wife, my mother, her husband-to-be, second husband-to-be, Elmer Hammer.
About 15 people.
Yeah, and my wife's best friend, Liza Redfield, who was a conductor, a classical music conductor. And we went to the same nightclub where we had originally had a date, and they had a dinner, we had a dinner there, which I had to pay for. And so that's how we met. Now we were married, and
we still paid.
And this is now we're still paying is right. And it's 38 years later, and we still never can remember our anniversary.